Hello and welcome to the first Student Loan Planner podcast episode of 2024. I'm excited today to talk about your top 10 financial dreams for 2024. We recently did a survey of our email list and we got thousands of responses back. And I'm going to share with you the top 10 broad financial dreams that our audience has for 2024. And I want to talk about how you can achieve either one of these top 10 dreams or your specific dream starting now in 2024. I think this is really exciting time to be a professional in your shoes, right? You have more power than you ever dreamed that you had. You have more opportunity than you think you have. And it's a lot of it's just because of needing to know the knowledge, the tools, and just knowing the path on how to get where you want to be. I used to be a bond trader. Some of you know that. When you think about bonds versus stocks, stocks is all optimistic people. And then in the bond world, you think about what's the worst thing that can happen. And so that's actually helpful thinking when it comes to trying to achieve your dreams. Because when you think about what is the worst thing that can happen, it's very helpful to define this. So this is also helpful for anybody that struggles with anxiety, like I happen to have struggled with throughout my life. At various times, it's very helpful to name the thing that what is it that you are afraid of? What is the worst thing that can happen if you pursue X, Y, and Z? That is a very powerful tool to get where you want to be faster. You could apply this line of thinking to a lot of different areas of your life. I think that this is going to be super helpful to anybody who's got something that's really gnawing at them in the back of their head about something they really want to do, some sort of, you know, career change or life change, or business you wanted to start, or side hustle you wanted to do, or, you know, investing account you want to open, or whatever it is that you're thinking about for your New Year's resolution, at least in the money side of your life, I think this episode will be really fun. So let me kind of just share a little bit about my personal story again to give you just the background of where am I coming from with what I'm about to share about these top 10 financial dreams that our audience has. I was in a big corporate job where the coworkers were wonderful. People were nice, but it wasn't for me, right? I was coming into work really early in the morning, leaving, and sort of woke up when it was dark, went home when it was dark, and was just like, is this all there is to life? And I was not a happy person. This was in my 20s. What I did is just, I was an impulsive saver back then. That's just what I did. I just saved everything I could, invested it, just because that's just what I'd always done in my life. It's kind of a weird kid. What happened is I discovered the FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early. It's my wife would maybe call it a cult. I don't think it's that. I think it can be very healthy if you don't take things too seriously, like anything. You do all things do in moderation and you can get a lot of good out of it. But basically the FIRE movement is this idea that you save a lot of your money and then you have options. That's really the best thing that it can be. I think there's maybe a little bit of a misconception that everybody that's into FIRE was trying to retire it, you know, at 30 years old. And I don't think that needs to be the case. A lot of it can just be becoming financially free, having control over your time and not having to do stuff that you don't want to do anymore, or at least minimizing having to do things that you don't want to do. So I was in this space of being at this big corporate job, not feeling like I was in the spot where my calling was and not feeling like my skills were in the best place. And essentially I discovered this whole FIRE movement thing. And then I started looking at my finances and I thought, okay, what's the worst that can happen? And I looked at the numbers and essentially as long as I could keep my spending down to about $20,000 a year, then I could basically not have to make an income for a long period of time, probably 10 to 15 years, maybe longer. And that was something that I had done because I saved a lot. I got lucky and saved a decent amount in college. Then I came out and saved like 50 to 70% of my income as a bond trader for several years out of college, and having a low six-figure portfolio gave me that financial security that I needed to feel like, oh, okay, I can go out and travel the world. And then the space that I had from all the stresses of day-to-day life is what allowed me to be able to start blogging. And I blogged really unsuccessfully for a long time about very broad topics that people didn't really care about except for close friends and family. And then I narrowed it down a lot to what there was a deep hunger and need for, which happened to be student loan analysis, and then found a product market fit and then launched Student Loan Planner kind of by accident at the urging of my wife and helping, you know, some of her friends and some of our friends make a plan to take that student loan obstacle off the table of all the things to worry about to be where you want to be. That really, interestingly enough, I don't know what the future holds, but, you know, historically that decision led to way more money, freedom, enjoyment, impact than I ever could have had if I'd stayed at that spot where I was in corporate America where I wasn't feeling fulfilled. Now, I want fulfillment for you, whatever that means. I want your biggest dream to be achieved, right? And I don't think that my story, it should be unusual. I think it should be a lot more usual. You know, there's a couple things in there that could be barriers to people, right? Getting significant financial capital, that could be a big obstacle to a lot of different people. I'm going to talk about some ways that where it doesn't need to be an obstacle in your life, but it could be a big hindrance to you feeling confident that you can go out and achieve what you want to achieve. Not having a lot of responsibilities. As a father to two kids, totally different stage of life that I'm in right now than I was when I was 20s and single. I mean, the idea of spending $20,000 a year, that's laughable to me now after going through all the necessary expenses to maintain sanity with, you know, two toddlers. You know, it's just like a very different thing. So I think that you can adapt this to your situation. I'm confident that you can. You might have to tweak things a little bit to make it applicable, but you absolutely can look at your downside and say, what's the worst thing that can happen? And then go pursue what you want to do a lot sooner than you ever thought you could. So let me share those top 10 dreams. And I'm going to break down the top 10 in no particular order. And I'm going to share a little bit about each one. Just some of my thoughts of if this particular dream applies to you in 2024, how you might be able to get there faster than you thought. That's what my goal is for each of these listing out of the top 10 financial dreams for our audience in 2024. Probably one of the most common, one of the top three was financial independence, financial freedom, retiring early, like the FIRE movement. That was a big theme in a lot of the responses. So why do people want to retire early? I think a lot of people look at loved ones in their life and they see stories of people that worked their whole life, woke up early, stayed late, took their 3 weeks of paid vacation, and then something terrible happens, a health problem develops, and then they get three golden years of retirement, and they pass away. Or they become impaired with some sort of psychological or health ailment, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, that doesn't really, it's more of a health ailment than a psychological ailment. But, you know, that happened to loved ones in my family, where you thought you were going to get a long time, and then suddenly something just very unfairly stops you in your tracks. When you are in your 20s, you don't think about your own mortality very much. You kind of feel like you're invincible. I don't know about you, but I had sort of a near-death experience when I was 19 or 20, when I was in a really bad car wreck and almost didn't make it from that. And so I started thinking about my own mortality, I guess, a lot earlier than maybe the average. Certainly now that I'm in my 30s and all these sudden, you know, joint aches and neck pain and stuff like that, I'm more aware of my mortality than I was in my 20s, right? But I think that this is where a lot of it comes from, is the idea of you don't know how long you have. And you want to be able to live your dreams and not have to feel like you had to do all the work that you were doing. Now, I think that work can be really purposeful. So I'm going to suggest an amendment to this idea of FIRE, and I'm going to suggest that you go Google the many different types of FIRE if you're interested in this. So there's things like lean FIRE, which is living on $20,000 a year. There's something called fat FIRE, which is living on $200,000 a year or more. Barista FIRE, where you just keep a very non-demanding job that happens to provide health insurance, so you don't have to worry about that at big expense. And then there's my favorite, which is Coast FIRE. Coast FIRE is really applicable to people who are great savers and have built up a significant nest egg, but they kind of actually have enough to just save a lower amount and work less, and then actually have enough to retire at a normal age. So this applies to a lot of medical professionals. So an example here is somebody that's working 60 hours a week, they're exhausted, they're making a high income, they really wish they could have more time with their family, and they have six figures of assets saved up. You might not realize this, right? But you could cut back a little bit, if possible, if your job will allow it. You can negotiate a little fewer hours, and then that would allow you to have a lower savings rate, but you might not need that high savings rate as much as you think you do. If you run the numbers, you know, if you've saved a lot in your earlier years, you can actually take your foot off the gas a little bit. Now, this can be game-changing if you have kids or you're, you know, having to take care of elderly parents or something like that. Just to be able to have a little more flexibility, a little more hours in your day, able to spend doing things that you want to do that are more important to you, or just having a better balance in life, that can be game-changing. And remember that, you know, a lot of people don't think about having a marginal tax rate and how that impacts things like being able to work less. So remember, when you make your final $1,000 that you're making, that is in whatever your top marginal tax rate is. That's the highest like percent of your income that gets taken away, right? So the marginal tax rates, I think it's like 12% is the lowest, I think. 22%, 24%. Then you have the 32% bracket that starts. That's a big jump. And then you have 35 and 37. So you might very well be with income-driven repayment added on. That's an extra 10% and an extra 5 to 10% for your state income tax. And then also throw in Social Security taxes if you happen to be, you know, in that range. You could really easily be paying 40% of your income in taxes on your last $1,000 earned and not even realize it. So that means if you can cut back on some non-deductible expenses, like maybe buy a little bit less nice of a car, maybe you kind of pivot away towards certain types of big ticket items, towards things that are quality but not as nice. If you can figure out a way to cut back on those non-deductible expenses, that last day a week of the 5 days a week you work, let's just say that you have make $100,000 a year, to make an example out of this. And let's say your fifth day of work per week is worth $20,000. You know, if your tax rate is 40% on that last bit of your income earned, then you're basically losing only $6,000. $12,000 is 20. I said $20,000 for that final fifth day a week. 0.6 times 20,000 is $12,000, right? So you're losing $12,000 a year. And if you looked at your budget, divide that by 12 and say that's $1,000 a month. So, okay, could you find a way to spend $1,000 a month less and still have a good life? Car payments, a lot of times, $600, $700 a month. If you drive a little bit older of a vehicle, you could be two-thirds of the way there. And then you cut out a couple unnecessary subscriptions. Maybe you pivot away towards the as many, whatever your big expense item is, a little less Amazon or something like that. And then you realize, oh my gosh, I could have three-day weekends every week. To me, that's a lot more exciting than trying to say, I'm going to retire at 50, because you don't know what's going to happen, and giving yourself that flexibility could be a real game changer. So think about Coast FIRE. Look that up. That's an interesting one. Coast FIRE, Fat FIRE, Lean FIRE. You could type in the different types of FIRE financial independence. There's a lot of good articles about it. Somebody's come up with like 30 different kinds. I think that's a little overkill. But this idea of I want to retire early, usually, in my experience, when somebody is talking about retiring early, there's a reason. And the reason could be you're working too much, or you're very cognizant of your own mortality, or a loved one you recently watched not get as many years as they deserved to enjoy their golden years. And we just want to not leave anything behind that we could have accomplished for you. That's a thought on FIRE. So that's number one. Number two is a lot of people said, I want to be able to help my family. This is really wonderful. I mean, if you think about what happens with a lot of Americans, a lot of folks are the first person in their family to go to college, or a lot of people are the first person in their family to go to graduate school. We have a lot of folks like that. You know, a lot of folks are second generation immigrant from second generation immigrant families, right? My wife falls into this category. So her parents immigrated, and then, you know, she's born in Canada, technically, but she's, you know, was born in North America and definitely has parents that don't have nearly as much as she does. And it's a real blessing to be able to help out, you know, her family and have the finances to be able to do that. And so this was a big goal that came up for a lot of people. And I would say to this, the first thing is what's the best way to help somebody? It doesn't necessarily mean that the best way to help somebody is just to give them money. It could be that, but it's not necessarily that. And I'll give you some examples. My in-laws didn't realize they would be able to retire, actually, until we looked at their stuff and I helped explain some things to them and showed them projected withdrawal rates and reviewed their asset allocation and things like that. And they realized that they could retire. Helping them avoid really expensive mortgages that are pitched to people sometime, that was a big way to help them save money. Helping them sign up for a very subsidized Affordable Care Act plan before they were eligible for Medicare was a big way to save them money, and helping them manage their AGI so that they could get basically almost $0 copays going to specialists with, you know, a subsidized silver plan with the ACA. So we also helped them out in other ways, but I just wanted to give you that as an example. that, you know, a whole lot of helping family out could not necessarily be you giving someone money. It could be helping them, if they're willing, optimize their situation better. I'm amazed at how many people don't know that you get more money if you put off claiming Social Security at until 70. You get way more money than if you claim it at 62. So many people don't know that. So many people don't know that if you spend down your money, your assets from age 62 to 70, just to delay needing to claim Social Security, that's one way that you can spend down everything and claim that max Social Security benefit and just have way, way more income. So many people don't know that if you set up a basic trust and put your primary home into it 5 years before you go into a nursing home, that's protected and Medicaid will cover almost all your nursing home costs in many cases. So many people don't know how to take advantage of the system in an ethical and legal way. I think that, you know, people that are coming from first generation families or immigrant families or families that didn't have a ton of money, which obviously if you're a student loan borrower, you know, a lot of folks are not coming from extremely wealthy families by definition, right? This is a wonderful way that you can help your family just by learning, just by being that person with your level of education who's like listening to podcasts like this, taking it all in, trying to give that back to people, trying to give that back to the people you love. That's a tremendous way to help. Another example is my parents didn't know about 1031 exchanges. They learned about that from me. And instead of paying a huge tax bill on something they had held since my dad was a very young professional, they were able to take that and convert it into something they could actually enjoy, right? Like a fun little vacation place that they could actually have some enjoyment out of in their golden years. They just didn't know about it. That wasn't me giving them money. It was just giving them the knowledge that I've gained over time as a financial professional. This could also be you. If you're a healthcare professional, right, you probably have a lot of people reach out and ask you for advice on things, and you're probably like, oh gosh, not another request. But don't underestimate how much that means to people when they're able to come to you and you're able to help others. It's a tremendous feeling, I think. So that's number two, and I promised 10, so I'll try to talk quicker. Number three is building wealth. A lot of people want to build wealth. Shocker there, right? Of course, everyone wants to build wealth. I think that there's a couple key ways that you can do this. One, get all your match in your retirement accounts. Two, put money into retirement accounts as much as you can on a pre-tax basis is what most people need to do because most people are in a much lower tax bracket in retirement. Open a brokerage account somewhere. Start putting money in, even if it's very small because that's all you can afford. That will be game-changing long-term. Most people never do that, and therefore you're putting that off and you're putting off that wealth growth. A lot of folks don't buy a house in a smart way. Whether or not you buy a house is heavily dependent on what part of the country you're in, how long you want to stay there, what your goals are. It's not a clear-cut decision on whether or not you should buy a house. Also, it's not a clear-cut decision as to whether or not you should get involved in real estate. It just depends. So in terms of building wealth, you can get there way, way faster if you take advantage of the lowest hanging fruit to build wealth. So what I mean by that is, okay, are you a health professional at a big health system? Okay, maybe you have access to multiple retirement accounts. You might have access to four. You might have access to a 401k or 403b, but then you might have access to a 457, an HSA, a 401a, right? Those are tons of different plans that you could maximize. Then you could start up a brokerage account as well and have yet another spot building wealth. When in doubt with building wealth, just throw it at multiple places. Typically, you want to throw it at student debt last, not always, but you want to be real careful throwing money on student loan debt that might not need to be paid out at all, especially if you could get subsidies on the save plan. You know, if you could get a very low interest rate, it might behoove you to go take that money and put it in a place that would get you 5%, like a money market temporarily, and just take that spread until the save plan interest starts kicking in and you have more to deal with. So building wealth is something that happens a lot faster when you either know what you're doing or you have someone on your team that helps you know what you're doing. But that's the third big goal that people had, financial dream they had for 2024 was build wealth. Number four is be debt-free. So many people want to be debt-free. I understand that very much. As a person who is not debt-free personally, let me share how to have debt impact you less. For student loan debt, remember that worst case scenario, your debt is a tax. It's a percent of your income. It's like an income tax. It's no different than choosing to live in Oregon State, which is like 10% income tax almost, versus living in Washington State where the income tax is zero. There's lots of people that live in Oregon still. Why? Because for whatever reason, they like to live in Oregon instead of Washington State. So remember this, if you're in Georgia and you're paying a 5% income tax instead of living in Florida, if let's say you have an income-driven repayment plan you're on, you're paying 10% of your income, that's actually about the same thing as New York state income tax, or it's not too dissimilar from that Georgia income tax or California. So the point is that if you think about your debt, not as a debt, but as a tax, it helps psychologically enormously. I've done a whole lot of consults where I'm talking about student debt and I show people, hey, if you optimize everything, you could get this percent of your income down to, sometimes if you're talking about a household, you can get it down to like 2% of somebody's income in some cases by maxing out retirement accounts, by filing taxes separately. Maybe you live in a community property state. Maybe you strategically delay filing your taxes through filing extensions. You know, you can really get that percent of your income down pretty low. So maybe you have the student loan debt and you want to be rid of it. I get that, right? But I'm not debt free. And the reason I'm not debt free is we have a 2.75% mortgage. Hopefully that didn't cause too many of you pain, right? Hopefully several of you have rates that low. Maybe you don't have a rate that low, but it's dependent on your situation. What is the reason you want to be debt-free? Is it because you feel stressed? Is it because you feel stressed by having to make a payment? Is it that you get nauseous opening your statements and seeing all the wealth that you don't have? Whatever it is, I suggest trying to get that negative thinking out of your mind, because that debt is actually not as bad as you think it is. If it's federal student debt, right? It's an income tax, and you live in the world's richest country still, and you have an education that most people don't have, and your unemployment rate for your occupation is a fraction of what it is for people that are not in your occupation in terms of, you know, compare your occupation to the population at large, right? I think people don't really realize how big of a difference that is. If you look at professional degree holders, unemployment rate on average is 2 to 3%. If you look at everybody else, it's like 5 to 10%, depending on if we're in a recession or not. So way bigger chance that other people are losing their jobs in a recession and not you. That's something where if you think about that debt-free aspect of things, if you have all your boxes checked, you've got disability insurance, term life insurance, you're in one of these jobs that has an education that other people don't have, then the debt isn't pleasant, but it's something that can be managed. And if you think about it like your student debt, like an income tax, then you just pay your income taxes, right? Yeah, I hate doing my tax returns and having to deal with tax stuff just as much as anybody else. But ultimately, luckily, I'm feeling blessed that I have the money to pay the taxes and I just pay it. And then with other kinds of debt, maybe it's credit cards, maybe it's mortgages, whatever it is, decide if there's an efficient way to handle it. Sometimes in the case of unsecured, you know, high interest debt like credit cards, you need to hire an attorney or go to a nonprofit consumer credit counseling agency or something. And sometimes the smart move is, if it's really debilitating, to look at settlement options, right? Sometimes it's best to try to get rid of it and just pay it off. If you've got a high interest rate mortgage, sometimes, not super common that I say this, but sometimes the solution is, okay, you're stressed about the amount of debt you have. Is there a way that you could sell your house and downsize? That's not that common, but it does happen. And sometimes people are so focused on being debt-free that they're not living their dream of living in a nice house. So it goes both ways. And debt freedom can't be the goal, because what's going to happen is, and I've seen this so many times, you get to debt freedom and you have that high of being debt free and you throw a party, paid off your mortgage, whatever it is. And then you go back to being exactly how happy you were before when you still had debt. So something to think about. Your happiness level will not change when you're debt free. So it's a good goal. And if you want to be debt free faster, there's lots of hacks you can use, right? But don't make it the focus. Number five, big dream for 2024, buy a fill in the blank. So this was a lot of things. There was like waterfront home, there was new car, you know, a lot of different things, new kitchen, et cetera. One thing that's going to help with your happiness level is if you can pay cash for something. If it's something that is not a long-term big ticket item like a house, if you're able to pay cash for something, it's a lot. Just to, from a happiness perspective, if you can, I'm not saying that you shouldn't finance something, but if you do finance something, there should be some sort of strategic reason. Otherwise, you could put yourself into a situation where it would be a drain on your happiness instead of an additive to your happiness. So an example of this would be, say you want to buy that vacation home. Now, most people are going to finance a vacation home, and I think that's okay. And if you rent it out only a certain amount of time, you know, a year, you might be able to deduct a lot of the expenses. Maybe it makes sense, too, from a business perspective to finance it. And you know what? I would probably try to finance a vacation home if the interest rate was decent and if I felt like, you know, I could get a better return on my money elsewhere. So maybe big ticket items, it's fine to finance them, but like smaller things like that new kitchen or the new car or something like that, if you can, try to put yourself in a situation where you can pay cash. And that might be a nice privilege that other people couldn't do. But what I don't want to have happen is you finance some kitchen renovation with a personal loan at a high interest rate, and now you're thinking about the monthly payment every time you use the thing. That's not necessarily a recipe for full enjoyment of that thing. So it might be better to wait a little bit on some big ticket items until you can just write the check and enjoy it that way. So that's one spot where I'm a little bit more conservative, is these sort of like five-figure type of ticket items. Be a little cautious. But the big ticket items, you know, sometimes it is okay to just go for it, the vacation home. I remember one call I had with a medical professional, and they were such a saver, super saver. They were saving like 35% of their income, and they had no desire to retire super early. And this was a very conservative person financially. And they were like, man, my big dream is like having a mountain cabin, but I just feel like I can't do it. And remember that earlier thought of defining your downside? So I said, okay, what's the worst that can happen? You buy this house, it goes down in value 30%, right? Yeah. So looking at the assets, this person had more than enough to pay down that loan and then sell off the asset if they needed to in a bad market. And so this person's downside was pretty much nil, except for losing a little bit of money. But this person had great coverage on all the insurances and had a successful practice. And so my suggestion to that person was, go buy that mountain cabin. Do it now. You know, if you can get a good deal on financing, go for it. And even if you can't get a good deal on it, maybe we'll be able to refinance it one day. Just make sure you put yourself in a situation where it's not like some weird exotic mortgage that's going to balloon on you, or the interest rate's going to reset to some really high level. But get some sort of vanilla mortgage if you need to, and go buy the mountain cabin. Again, it's just sort of like a, you know, whatever thing you're thinking about doing, you should probably do it. There's smart ways to go about it. Number six, big dream, was become a business owner or practice owner. A lot of people, man, I can't tell you how many times I've talked to hundreds, maybe actually thousands even, of especially like dentists, dental professionals, and veterinarians to a lesser extent, and physicians sometimes as well. And they have this big dream of, I want to be a partner. I want to be a business owner. I want to be a practice owner. I want to have freedom to make my own decisions and run my own outfit. And there's always a reason not to do it. Oh, the money's too big. The practice loan's too large. I don't want to be thinking about my practice loan and my mortgage. I don't want to be thinking about my student loan and my practice loan. But you've got to compare being a business owner with your education. And I'm assuming that's what we're talking about here, using your skills in a setting where, you know, you're the provider of the service. You're the business owner providing the service, right? Hiring other people in some cases to help you provide the service. Your probability of success is almost 99%. It's actually probably more than 99%. If you look at the probability of success for somebody opening a pizza shop in a strip mall, it's like 20% or 30%. We're talking 5 years in. When you're talking about becoming a business owner, your fear of failure should be way low, and the pizza shop owner's, you know, fear of failure should be way high, because that's what the numbers show. But usually what I see is, you know, the pizza shop owners are underestimating the risk, and the medical professionals are overestimating the risk. Partly that could be medical professionals, I think, by nature, are maybe a little bit more risk averse or a little more conservative, which is probably what you want in somebody that's trying to figure out what's wrong with somebody, what medical treatment should we give somebody, right? You probably shouldn't be shooting from the hip. Hey, let's just try this and see what happens, right? But, you know, in terms of being a business owner, if that's one of your goals in 2024, I say go for it. If you're needing to become a partner in your practice and your boss has been putting off that partnership conversation, make that person make time. Don't underestimate your value. Don't underestimate how important you are to that practice. And it might well be true that that business owner could replace your position. But, you know, it's also true that it would be very costly for them to replace that position. So make this year, if you're interested in being a business owner of some kind, make this year be the situation where you really go all in for it. because the probability of failure, remember your downside risk is very, very low. Number seven is becoming a homeowner, owning a home. Some people's was upgrading my home. Remember that as a professional, some people have access to doctor mortgages where you could put down 0 to 10%, no PMI. You can deduct all the interest of a mortgage up to $750K of principal. Above that, it's not deductible. But interest rates, yeah, they're not good. 6, 7, 8% in some cases. Is that low by historical standards? Yes. If we had a lot lower interest rate environment, would you be able to refinance to a much lower payment? Yes. Will the Fed probably slash interest rates aggressively the next time we have a bad recession, which could open up refinancing opportunities? And might they, you know, buy up mortgage bonds again? They very well could, right? So in that line of thinking, the big risk in becoming a homeowner is when you buy too much house relative to your income that you feel good about. So what I mean by that is, let's say you're a dual income household making $300,000 a year. You know, we have a mortgage calculator on studentloanplanner.com. In the calculators part of the menu, you can click on it. And you can even use this for doctor mortgage calculations too. If you qualify for one of those, you can put in your down payment amount, and you can also throw in estimates for homeowners insurance and property taxes, HOA if applicable, maintenance costs. And what you can see is, what is the percent of my income going to housing? If that number is below 1/3, you're probably good. If it's above 1/3, you might be in a situation where you can't afford to do other things that you want to do in life because you're stuck with a big housing payment. And that's heavily dependent upon what part of the country you're in. So I had one consult the other day with somebody in San Francisco, you know, looking at their rent compared to the prices of homes, it's out of control. There's no financial reason to buy a house in San Francisco at all. What I mean by that is the price to rent ratio, the price divided by the annual rent of a home, it's like 50 to 1. It's like 50 is the ratio. Now, if you go over and you look at like Omaha, Nebraska, it might be like 15 or 10. Now, that's not to say that people could become even crazier about San Francisco real estate than they are, and maybe that ratio goes up higher. It could happen. But as a general financial rule, if you want to be a homeowner and you're in the Bay Area, then it needs to be thought of as a luxury purchase. You're absolutely not throwing money away as a renter in the Bay Area. In fact, you're probably throwing money away being a homeowner, to be honest. Now, in a place like middle of nowhere, Wisconsin, you know, it's probably the reverse, where maybe you are throwing away money being a renter instead of a homeowner. So it's heavily dependent on one part of the country you're in. And the thing is your dream takes precedence over the finances of it. So if you want to be a homeowner so bad that that's what you really want out of life, that's just one of your number one goals, be a homeowner. But if you're in a very expensive place of the country, part of the country, decide what percent of my income do I want going into housing, and what is that going to mean for the other things I like to do? So will you have enough money left over to travel? Will you have enough money left over to pay for daycare and pay for somebody to clean your house if that's not something you enjoy? Will you have enough money to drive the cars that you want to drive or experience the hobbies that you want to experience? So all this, you want to be thinking about things in terms of balance. And I think that if you want to be a homeowner, if you're waiting for lower interest rates, don't wait. Now is a wonderful time to become a homeowner if you buy reasonably. It's a reasonable percent of your income. You're buying for the right reasons. You know, you're not buying because you think you're going to become rich from it. Great time to be a homeowner if that's the thought process. Next top goal is traveling. Now, that's something I can get behind. I think this is the 8th goal. I think it just depends on what kind of travel you want to do. When I was younger, just traveling, period, was the goal. And I lived through all kinds of weird stuff, like went on like a 20-hour bus ride once in Central America with like my knees jammed up against my chest, and it was very unpleasant, but it was still super fun. And then traveled all over Central and Eastern Europe when I was not working for a period in my 20s, when I was quote-unquote early retired, and it was wonderful. Now, when I think about, you know, traveling with a family, it's totally different. I have to think about my wife's preferences and comfort. I have to think about the kids and them being comfortable and safe and everything. So travel needs to be something that fits with whatever you're trying to do. Now, in terms of the costs of things, if you look at the expenses with travel, it's absolutely exponential in terms of the amount you can spend. So an example is, you know, if you look at Motel 6 versus Holiday Inn Express, right? You might be paying double or triple to stay in the Holiday Inn Express, but the plus side is you at least don't feel, you know, Now I'm going to get in trouble because somebody's family is going to be the franchiser of Motel 6. And I'm sure a lot of Motel 6 is really nice. But, you know, the reputation. A lot of people would be like, oh my gosh, that's so worth it. But compare the Holiday Inn Express to the Four Seasons, and it's like, oh my gosh, the Four Seasons is so much nicer. Golly, let me stay there. But the Four Seasons might be like 7x what the Holiday Inn Express might be, or maybe it's 3 or 4x. So in other words, there's lots of opportunities if you want to travel more to pick the value play in travel. So maybe you try to fly on Tuesdays. Maybe you try to go in off seasons. Maybe you stay at a step above the cheapest budget option hotel, but you stay away from the 4 and 5 star hotels where everything's an expense. Maybe you do credit card churning if you're very responsible with it and you are really creative. And if you're doing a side hustle or you have a business, maybe you could write off a lot of your travel and, you know, legitimately call things a business expense. So I think that with the travel thing, I think also too, what affects it is the number of hours you've got to work. If you're forced to have a limited amount of vacation, it's kind of hard to plan a vacation around that. You get home and you're exhausted from the trip, but you don't have any time to recover because you got to get back into it. So I think travel is something that people really love talking about traveling and doing it, but then there's always a reason you can't do it. Financial, time, you've got young kids, right? But I would just encourage you to just throw all that to the wind and just go for it. What's the worst thing that can happen? You get some sort of illness or something? I mean, that's maybe the worst thing financially is, you know, you blow a hole in your budget, but travel is usually not the thing that does it in my experience, especially if you're avoiding the most expensive options, right? If you're avoiding first class, then the Four Seasons, if you're not a multimillionaire, it's pretty hard to blow a hole in your budget with travel. Usually I see it with housing. Almost always it's housing and to a lesser extent vehicles. So housing and vehicles are the two things after talking to thousands of people doing one-on-one consultations with folks. Those are always the two big things that really just are preventing people from achieving what they want, a lot more so than student loan debt, to be honest with you. So go for it. If you want to travel, go for it. Number 9, big goal, big dream for 2024, multiple streams of income or side hustles. So everybody kind of, I think, feels insecure about their income. What if AI comes into radiology and takes all the radiologists away? What if you get additional states that are doing anesthesiologist assistant programs that take away the really high incomes of anesthesiologists, right? What if people create mid-level dental providers and take away the high incomes of dentists? There's always this what ifs that creates fear and anxiety and I think drives people to want to have multiple streams of income. Sometimes people just like it. They think it's fun. That's fine. I would say whatever the reason is for the multiple streams of income, I think of it as a positive thing, like, you know, diversification, it's good, but multiple streams of income could be two, right? You could be having dividend paying stocks, stocks that go up with capital gains because of share buybacks. You could have bonds. That's already two streams of income, right? And then if you have like your home, you could rent that out up to 2 weeks a year and potentially deduct those expenses or not have to pay taxes on those expenses. You know, there's all kinds of like creative ways to think about multiple streams of income and whatever the reason is for wanting that, if there's any like fear or anxiety based reason for wanting that, definitely go look at the unemployment statistics for your profession and realize that basically in America, we have extremely powerful professional lobbies. It's very unlikely that your income is going to get taken away because of some sort of thing that happens, right? If anything, it probably just makes you even more effective and even more valuable with your time because you're probably doing even, you're probably spending your limited time doing even more complicated procedures or something like that. Now, the number 10, hit a certain net worth goal or hit a certain amount of X millions of dollars of assets. That is something you can define. It's based on savings rate. It's based off of returns you get in your investment portfolio. You can get there a lot faster than you think if you efficiently use the different vehicles available to you for wealth growth. One cautionary tale, though, is if you are hoping for hitting a certain net worth to make you feel good, again, this goes back to that earlier goal of being debt-free. No amount of net worth is going to make you feel settled, ever. If you look at all the studies out there, almost all of them say that people that have a certain amount of net worth consistently report that if they only had twice as much as they currently have, then they would feel secure. This is true for people that have a million or 5 million or 10 million or 50 million or 200 million. Everybody feels like they need twice as much And I think this is, you know, why there's warnings in, you know, major religions of the world to not covet, right? Because it's a recipe for unhappiness. Now, that said, I do think it's wonderful to have a positive net worth goal, and I think it's wonderful to have a specific net worth goal. Just don't overvalue it, is all I'm saying. And to get there, remember the vehicles like the 401ks, retirement accounts, brokerage accounts, investing. It's really wonderful. It's a great feeling. I will say that. It's a wonderful feeling to look at your assets and say, I made it to millionaire status. Heck yeah. I made it to quinta, what is the word for five? Five millionaire status or 10 millionaire, you know, whatever your goal is, right? Maybe it's just, I want to be positive net worth, including my student loans. That's a good thing. I want to certainly say that's a wonderful dream. And I just would encourage you to think deeper about that if that's your top goal and say, what other thing do you really want? Like, just keep going down the layers of things. Like, well, why do you want to hit that amount of net worth? Maybe it's because you want to retire early. Oh, okay. Have you ever thought about Coast Fire, where you could reduce your hours now instead of trying to go for early retirement cold turkey at an early age? What are your big financial dreams of 2024? Whatever they are, you can absolutely hit them sooner than you think by defining the downside. What is the worst that can happen? What is the absolute big disaster in terms of how this happens? What people will you disappoint? Do you care that much about disappointing them? Maybe actually they wouldn't be all that disappointed at all. Maybe that you're imagining, you know, you would let down somebody as you in your head creating negative thoughts and catastrophizing when you don't deserve to do that to yourself. I think that a lot of us in the modern era with like Instagram, TikTok, all these things, it is so easy to see other people's perfect curated lives and say, why don't I have that? What's wrong with me? Why can't I achieve what they have? And the reality is, social media is interesting in some ways, but I also think it can be so toxic because it takes away the reality of like the struggle and what happens when you don't have the perfect Instagram shot and what happens when you come home and have to pay for that really expensive vacation that you financed on the credit cards, and that creates stress in your relationship. Have your best life. Don't have somebody else's best life. You deserve your best life. And the way you get there is that knowledge or the loopholes, right? The, oh, I can file separately and get on this repayment plan and reduce my AGI and do this depreciation strategy. And then that's going to give me a $100 a month payment and get me out of debt in 20 years paying $100 a month. That's wonderful. That's awesome. Go celebrate. I can get health insurance subsidized by knowing about the silver plans, by signing up the right way, by choosing the right comparison tool to see if my doctors are covered. And now I can go start a business. That's awesome. You can save money on taxes that you also get to write off against, you know, the business that you sell one day because you open a brokerage account, you optimize things, or you hire an advisor or something that can optimize things for you. Now you're getting to buy that vacation home of your dreams much faster. Maybe you didn't know about the loophole where you could, you know, rent out your house during graduation weekend because you live right next to a college campus and you make $5,000 that you can use to take the whole family to Disney or something. All these like loopholes, I think people don't think about them. I think a lot of times people don't know about them. And I think a lot of times that people don't know the statistics of like the worst case scenario, right? Like it's real common if you say like, what's the worst case scenario? Like this is a big thing in psychology. Like people usually define a worst case scenario worse than it actually is by a long shot. Like if you ask people, for example, like, you know, what's the number of people struck by lightning a year, or what's the number of people that get eaten by sharks? That's a little gross to say that, but you know, you ask questions like that and people tend to way overestimate the terrible thing. So like research that, find out what that downside is. And now think about all the positive, wonderful things that you could do. Think about the trips you're going to take, the houses you're going to buy, the businesses you're going to start. Think about the wealth growth that's going to happen. Think about the generational wealth that you're going to create for your family, both for the people older than you and for the people younger than you. Think about the freedom that you're going to unlock in your life, where you're no longer devastatedly worried about your debt because it doesn't hold you back anymore. I'm just really excited for you for 2024. I think that we all have to fight back against this negative mindset of the catastrophizing, the negative thoughts, the what ifs, the I'm not capable of this, I'm not good enough, the imposter syndrome, just like junk all of it. You need the tools, like the investing accounts, like the loopholes, those sorts of things, the knowledge, How do you use the tools? How do you use the retirement accounts? How do you do the investing stuff or the tax stuff or the student loan stuff, right? And then you also need accountability. Now, accountability can be family, it can be friends, it can be a blog you follow, a podcast like this one. It can also be somebody you hire whose professional job is to keep you accountable, like a financial advisor. So we've got a lot more for you next week. I hope you have a wonderful 2024. I hope you had a wonderful new year. And I've got some exciting stuff to share for next Tuesday's pod. But until then, thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. I'm so excited for all the stuff that you are definitely going to achieve, all the dreams you're going to get way closer to in 2024. Have a great week.